Sports World, where we talk to the most interesting people in the world on KABF 88.3, the voice of the people.
You want to see how the other half lives? We'll see how we get around. Why don't you come visit me on the east?
This is Wade Rathke, and you're listening to Wade's World, a voice of the people program. Welcome to the east side of town so that we can talk about how the other half lives and what life is like here living in Wade's World, whether that's the east side of Little Rock, Greenville, or New Orleans, or on Acorn Radio in Nairobi, Kampala, Bengaluru, Bristol, or Bombay. Points east and west, where we are either rebroadcast or live streamed at kbf.org, wamf.org, or acornradio.org. A podcast will be available of this show on these websites and at www.chieforganizer.org. You know the story on Wade's World. We talk to the most interesting people in the world. Today we're talking to Andy Bowman, who is a serial energy entrepreneur based in Texas, about his new book, The West Texas Power Plant That Saved the World, Energy Capitalism and Climate Change. Welcome to Wade's World, Andy.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's good to have you here. So it's a big thing to change the world. So how did that work out? Tell us how you decided to do this book. A little bit about this plant that saved the world.
Yeah. I think it's impossible to avoid news these days about climate change. And this has been going on for a long time. I think most of us see it in our daily lives now. And when you look into the details, somewhere near 80% of global warming happens from burning fossil fuels one way or another. And what I've been involved with in my career is renewable energy, wind and then solar. And, it's become the most effective way to try to limit greenhouse gases is building more of these renewable energy power plants everywhere. The power plant that's the subject of the book is a very small solar project out in West Texas. There are a ton of solar projects in West Texas and Arizona and California and all over the world. This one is special because it's financed in a very unique way. And that sounds really boring and maybe not having much to do with climate change, but it's actually really important. What happened is, generally when you build a power plant, you've got to operate it for 10 or 20 years to recover the investment that's made to build the plant. And so the way that almost every power plant anywhere gets built is with a long-term contract in place before you start construction from somebody promising to buy all the power from it. Without a contract like that, typically you can't get the project financed. What's unique about this project is that it was built without a contract like that. In history, the only kinds of power plants that can be built without a contract are plants that sell power at such a competitive price that they are confident they're going to get their return even without a contract in place to sell the power over, decades. The only kinds of power plants that have been built this way in the past are natural gas and coal power plants. And so what this small project out in West Texas says about the state of things is that solar energy has been getting so much cheaper over such a short period of time that it has crossed that threshold and now become a technology that produces power cheaper than the market price. And with this small plant being built in the way that it was, it's kind of a signpost that the game has changed and that now the cheapest power you can get is solar. Since this one power plant, this is the first one ever to be built this way, since it was constructed, we've seen more and more of them popping up, not just here in the U.S., but around the world. And it's a trend that seems to be gaining momentum, each year that goes by, because solar is getting cheaper and cheaper, while a lot of other energy sources like natural gas and coal, for instance, have been either staying the same or in some cases getting more expensive. So that's the story behind the main power plant. Pardon me, that's the subject of the book.
Well, it may seem arcane and like we're getting into, you know, sophisticated energy financing, but really the story of long-term locked-in contracts is part of the problem we're dealing with in trying to transition away from coal, isn't it?
It really is. And, you know, it goes back to this central fact about if most of the emissions that are driving climate change are coming from burning fossil fuels, they're either getting burned in a power plant or in a combustion engine in some kind of vehicle getting us from point A to point B. You know, there are other sources, but those are the biggest ones. And the way that we build the power plants that keep our world running is, like I was saying, with these long-term contracts in place. When you build a power plant and finance it with that kind of a lifetime needed to recover the investment, you've locked in operation of that plant for that period of time. And so all of these long-term contracts and basically just the way that we've run the power generation sector, every time one gets built, it doesn't just get built for a year or two. It gets built for 10 or 20 or 30 years. And so, you know, the disruptive power of these much cheaper clean energy supplies is really affecting the industry in a good way. We're seeing huge growth of wind and of solar, solar more than wind, much more in the last several years. But it's starting to change the picture and change it in meaningful ways.
Before, you had a lot of experience with wind generation in Texas. How much of the power in Texas now comes from solar and wind? That's a pretty good plump.
Yeah, it's really a surprising amount. You know, the first wind projects were built in Texas back in the late 1990s. And there have just been more and more of them built every year since, and there will be many more built in the next several years. Solar has really gotten going during the 2010s, during, you know, really kind of from 2013, 2014 on. The next couple of years look like they will be the biggest years for solar in Texas. And, you know, the amount of power that we use here in Texas that comes from wind and solar, it varies by time of year. In the spring and in the fall, we don't use that much electricity, and it's very windy. And so we can see days in the spring and the fall when we're either side of 40 or 50 or 60%, even coming from wind and solar. In the summer and in the winter, that's a smaller percentage because we're using more, and you know, it doesn't make up, you know, all of the generation that we have available to us. But what you're seeing in Texas is is a larger and larger amount that comes from wind and solar. And the grid here put out a report late last year looking forward the next couple of years. And what they're foreseeing is an increasingly high percentage that's coming from renewables. They're projecting, pardon me, that we'll be seeing anywhere from 40 to 60% on a pretty regular basis, and sometimes even up to 80%, which is a really remarkable thing for a grid, you know, anywhere in the world.
We're talking to Andy Bowman, who's written a book called The West Texas Power Plant to Save the World, Energy Capitalism and Climate Change. So I got two questions for you, but first let me ask you, how's that plant doing out in West Texas?
Yeah, the plant is continuing on and producing, and power prices have been, you know, unusually high, especially running up to the pandemic. Like everywhere, you know, Texas saw a lot of negative effects economically from the pandemic. But the plant is doing well. It had trouble financially a couple years after it got going, like a huge number of other power plants did, because the price of power got much cheaper. And so when you lived on the market, you saw your revenues decline. you know, not just that power plant, but other natural gas power plants. You know, everybody in the market saw a tough time there, but it's continuing on and is doing well. And like I say, we're seeing more and more other solar plants get built in Texas, and you know, it seems to be a really favorable market for solar.
When we talk about the grid, it gets complicated in Texas, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Texas is a unique part of the U.S. electrical system. We have our own grid. There's the eastern grid in the United States, the western grid, and then there's the Texas grid, which is called ERCOT, the Electric Reliability Council of Texas. And while there are a few interconnections to the eastern and the western grids, and even to Mexico, they're quite small. And so Texas kind of stands on its own, which, as we've seen over the last year, you know, is an important fact in how Texas meets its needs, depending on what the weather is.
Is the little power plant in West Texas part of the western grid? Because I know part of El Paso is on the western grid. It's one of the few places in Texas that's outside of the ERCOT, isn't it?
Right. The El Paso is in the western grid. Parts of the Texas Panhandle are in the western grid, and then parts of East Texas are in the eastern grid. And but the power plant that's the subject of the book is in ERCOT, is in the main Texas grid.
I was curious, and I knew sort of where you described it. I'm not sure exactly mm-hmm. that I know the town, but I knew it had to be close to the borderline. But and the problem, I mean, you were mentioning how much wind and solar. I mean, that might surprise some of our listeners that Texas, being big oil and gas country, is such a leader, relatively speaking, in the country on wind and solar. But there's a lot of excess capacity, people say, that in the seasons you're discussing that could be sold, but the grid in Texas isn't connected, is it?
That's right. You know, there are so many wind projects in West Texas and in the Panhandle, and increasingly there's, you know, more solar projects in that part of the state as well. There are a lot of solar projects planned for, you know, other parts of Texas as well, you know, in the North Texas Dallas area, you know, east and west of Houston, down in the valley in South Texas. But what's important to understand is that the transmission system has a finite capacity to transmit energy. And so when you have a bunch of, say, wind farms in one geographic area, and they all start producing at full capacity, if there's a high wind day, they can produce more electricity than can fit into those power lines going, say, east to Houston and Dallas and Austin, which is where the majority of the load here is in Texas, in the eastern half of the state. And so what happens when you have an oversupply like that is that the price out there in the wind area is determined on a supply and demand basis. And so when you have way more supply than there is demand, the prices fall. And that's the way that an energy surplus plays out. And it's a really inefficient outcome. You've got a ton of power being produced out there and still a strong demand in the eastern part of the state, but you can't get it from A to B. And this doesn't just happen in Texas. This happens in a variety of places, California, New England, you know, anywhere where you've got a big wind production area and you know, a load center far away. And it's a hard problem. You know, it could be addressed with building new transmission. Texas has done that in the past and built quite a bit of transmission to accommodate, you know, all the wind that we have available. We did that many years ago and connected the Texas Panhandle, which has brought a huge amount of cheap, clean energy to the rest of the state. But we really, you know, you could, you could spend a lot of money building new transmission, and that is a really important part of the solution going forward. But increasingly, there are other solutions like energy storage, and this is more of a market-based approach, but there are many people focused on this in Europe, in Asia, all across the U.S., trying to soak up that extra energy and then discharge it into the transmission lines when there's more room. And that'll be an important way for renewables to grow in the future as well.
We had the big, big power shortage in the winter in Texas back, not this winter so far, knock on wood, but last winter. How, I mean, the impact was at different points, millions were without power and some for a long period of time. Did that not put some pressure on political leaders in Texas to do something about this transmission problem?
It has. It has really put a spotlight on a number of issues that that leaders have been, you know, very focused on since then. You know, when your own grid separated, you know, almost entirely from the rest of the country, you know, you've got to be in a position to be quite self-sufficient. And what happened last February was that the temperatures were so cold that a number of power plants stopped operating. The liquids in various lines froze, so they couldn't safely operate. An even bigger problem was that many of the natural gas production facilities also were unable to operate because the temperatures were so cold it exceeded the operating parameters. And so not only did you have many power plants that couldn't work, you also had not enough natural gas to burn in them because we couldn't get that from A to B. You also saw, you know, some wind projects not producing as much. They had ice on the blades and other issues. And you even saw some solar production fall off because of snow on the panels and that kind of thing. So we had issues all the way across. And I think one of the things that we learned is how incredibly important, you know, preserving a reliable energy source is for everybody. I mean, we had, you know, hundreds of people die in the state, upwards of 200 people. We had all kinds of economic destruction, you know, disruption in people's lives. It was a terrible, terrible event. And we've, you know, the state has made a lot of changes to weatherize. So far, more transmission is not part of the discussion. I do think a lot of the changes that have been made are going to be really helpful. But it was quite a test that we had. And I think it's, if we had a similar event, we would have a lot of problems from it. And we've got to look hard at this situation. And I think there are likely more changes that need to be made.
There was an op-ed recently in the New York Times about this grid problem that quoted former governor and energy secretary Rick Perry from Texas saying, you know, we don't want to do anything about our grid. We want a separate Texas grid, in essence, because we don't want anybody telling us what to do with the grid. But Texas is connected in a million other ways to the rest of the country. So it's like a weird comment. Andy, I don't know if you saw that op-ed, but wow.
Yeah.
I mean, it was sort of like, what kind of rock did Perry crawl out from under, and former energy secretary? I mean, I hadn't seen his name in the paper recently, but that was his Earl Butts moment, I think. Has that opinion really shared by people? Because telephone network, I mean, there's a million ways they're connected, including, as you just said, part of East Texas and part of West Texas is part of, you know, what's connected to the rest of the world in the U.S. So,
yeah.
Is this really just a political, you know, sort of lockdown, or is this, it can't be people like you who are in the business, you know, really are supportive of this at this point? I mean,
yeah, it's, you know, I think part of Texas's political culture and identity, you know, for better or worse, is a very, you know, broad independent stripe. I think there are some who really want our system to remain the way that it is. I think the idea of, you know, more federal regulation is kind of what underpins Perry's statement. Texas already complies with a lot of federal regulation in the power space, you know, voluntarily imposing the same standards that are used in the rest of the country. So I think it's a bigger talking point than a real issue. I do think that one of the things that came out of that storm is that there's a lot of benefit from having bigger connections to these other grids, the Eastern Grid and the Western Grid. As a practical matter, you know, the regulatory hurdles to getting those connections approved and getting them constructed are pretty significant. It's probably not something that's going to happen quickly. And, you know, the real question as you look at climate change is, you know, when is the next event going to happen? And are we doing the things we need to do to prepare quickly enough? And, you know, this was a winter event that had a terrible loss of life and property, as we were just talking about. But in a lot of ways, the one to worry about is a terrible summer event, heat event. In really hot days without power, we see a much greater loss of life. Texas gets very hot in the summer, and you don't have to go back very far to find a summer crisis that with a few things going wrong, could have been much worse even than it was. And I'm talking about 2011, a record-breaking heat and drought all across the state. In that situation, we had many thermal plants, gas and coal plants, that couldn't run because the water temperature and the cooling legs that's used to keep the equipment cool enough to operate, the temperature in those lakes got so warm that it couldn't be used anymore to safely cool the plant. So the plants had to go offline. In other cases, the drought was so bad that the water line in the lakes went below the intake, and so they didn't have water to cool and safely operate. In a situation where we have a summer like 2011, you know, we'd see a really terrible set of challenges. And that's probably the more likely scenario than another, you know, five-day polar vortex. And we've got a lot of work to do to be prepared for that. And having more grid interconnections would be a help to us for sure if that happens.
It's definitely a message from the universe. We're talking to Andy Bowman, who's a longtime serial entrepreneur in the energy sector. He's written a book called The West Texas Power Plant That Saved the World, Energy Capitalism and Climate Change. Got another one for you, Andy. So in that same winter vortex thing, one of the things that was confusing to people outside of Texas, and I think even in Texas, is how people ended up with such humongous energy bills in some cases, mm-hmm. because of where the unique way that the power markets work in a deregulated fashion in Texas. That was just crazy. And I know... Even Texas had to talk about how to bail people out in some cases. But has that changed at all? I mean, that's sort of an Enron, you know, bit small or something. But what in the world? Is that has there been progress in that area?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it is one of the lesser known parts of that whole crisis, is the unbelievable economic destruction of companies. Because the price of power got so expensive during the crisis, I mean, all kinds of power-related companies had promised to deliver at a certain price and had to purchase power at an incredibly high price in order to meet their obligations. And so they've gone away. The wave of bankruptcies And, you know, liquidations that have come out of the crisis is really staggering. And, you know, it's not as, you know, easily understood a story as all the personal difficulties that people had, but it's huge. It is a
Andy,
outcome.
Some of those
this.
Boys must have been Republican contributors too. So I bet in Austin at the Capitol, they must have heard from one or two of them as they went down.
Yes, absolutely. It is a bipartisan issue all the way across, and the core factor here is that the way that we run the ERCOT grid, the main grid in Texas, is on a scarcity pricing basis. So when there isn't much power, the market sends a signal with a really high price to attract more power to show up. Whereas the average price of power in ERCOT might be about $25 a megawatt hour, the price during the storm was $9,000 per megawatt hour for days on end. And so that delta from $25 to $9,000 is what rolled through, you know, so many companies that had these obligations to deliver and couldn't pay. I mean, that is just an enormous sum. The way that the market design was set up was to send those really high price signals to incentivize people to build new power plants. And I don't know that people thought all the way through about how this could play out in an event like what happened in February. And part of the reaction to the storm has been a reconsideration of the market design, and that's ongoing here in ERCOT at the Public Utility Commission. And then, you know, we've also seen in the news lately the trial of a co-op that has gone bankrupt, and testimony about, you know, how exactly these decisions got made about the price of power during the storm. And it seems like that's still a story that's unfolding there. So we'll learn more about it.
And it may all sound complicated, and we may be mass shaming a lot of our listeners, but it's really anybody who's ever had to take an Uber knows what we're talking about, because they use what they call surge pricing, which is exactly the same thing as what you're talking about, you know, scarcity pricing. You know, if all of a sudden it's pouring down rain and the wind is blowing, and you're trying to get from the New Orleans Superdome home, and you called your Uber or to the airport, you may pay, you know, $100, not the normal $20, if that's the only way you can get there. And large and in the billions, that's what Texas went through. We've been talking to Andy Bowman, who's a longtime, I've used him as an energy expert, but he's also a longtime energy entrepreneur, largely in the wind sector, but also in solar. He wrote a book called The West Texas Power Plant That Saved the World, Energy Capitalism and Climate Change. Andy, how can people get this book?
Yeah, the book is available in many local bookstores. It can be ordered in your local bookstore. It's also available online at Amazon and Barnes & Noble. And I have a website at andywbowman.com that can lead you to it as well.
And if people want to continue this conversation with you, Andy, if they go on that website, is there a way to contact you there?
There is. I would love to hear from people. And there is a feature on that website that people can reach me, and I'd love to hear and respond.
Well, I've got one final question before I close out this show. Now, you didn't get you didn't have to go under during this crisis.
www.inthepublicinterest.org.
We lost we have power for about a half a day, so I was one of the lucky ones, and I really can't explain why. And so many people had lost power for, you know, 3, 4, 5 days, but we got lucky.
For folks to reach out and for us, you know,
glad to hear it.
Good to be back in touch. Thanks so much for being with us, Donald. Good luck with the book.
This
has been Wade's World for another week,
A World
Where the Other Half Lives, where we talk about things you've never heard. And as
Lucinda
Williams sings, things you've never seen, we'll never forget.
Wade's
World is underwritten by the Darrell Foundation, a progressive force, and they've changed based in Little Rock, Arkansas. And as the song goes, we say it loud, we say it on the air, we say it on the radio. Until next week,
we'll have another guest.
This is Wade Brasky for Wade's World.
Thank you.